This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
G-A-L-D-E-M. G-A-L-D-E-M.
This song is good.
Hello and welcome to Galdem's first ever podcast. Inspired by our book, I Will Not Be Erased, our stories about growing up as people of colour. My name's Liv, I'm Galdem's founder, and for those of you who don't know, Galdem is an award-winning media company committed to platforming the voices, perspectives, and creative work of women and non-binary people of colour.
Hello, I'm Charlie. I'm the head of editorial at Galdem, and I'll be co-hosting our podcast with Liv. We're super excited to be starting our journey with you. Each week, we'll invite a guest to respond to old diary entries, letters, or text messages from their younger selves. The point is to nurture important discussions about growing up.
You can find Growing Up with Galdem on Apple Podcasts, the Acast app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to our podcast, Growing Up with Galdem.
So today on Growing Up with Galdem, we are joined by the incredible Charmaine Lovegrove, who is a good friend of ours, a mentor, and she's also been on Galdem's advisory board for some time. She is famously the publisher of Dialogue Books, which is an inclusive imprint as part of the Little Brown book group at her shop. Charmaine has worked in many, many kind of different careers, different roles, different jobs. She was also the literary editor of Elle and set up her own bookshop and creative agency whilst living in Berlin, which she's now just returned to during this lockdown period. She's also on the board of the Black Cultural Archives and is also a founding organiser of the newly established Black Writers Guild. So we're really, really excited to have you here with us today, Charmaine. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm really happy to be here and just always just love everything that you do. It's always surprising and illuminating and inspiring. So thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Charmaine. So I've been really enjoying your kind of joyous updates from Berlin. And I feel like you always have brilliant sort of posts on social media, but during the pandemic, they've been bringing me like particular joy. How has the pandemic period been for you? Do you feel like you've learned a lot about yourself? And I'm curious to know, with the move to Berlin as well, did that all kind of take place within the confines of the pandemic? Did you have the idea that you were going to move during the pandemic and then sort of put the plans in place, or was it kind of in the back of your mind from before then? Or
so, as you know, I'm a really deeply political person. My husband and I had just sort of moved back to the UK. We'd only been there a year, and then the referendum happened, and obviously we were not expecting the result. And we sort of had two things that we decided after the 24th of June 2016 that we would do, or sort of two caveats. And the caveats were, we didn't have the language of no deal, but if the negotiations went badly and we would lose our rights as Europeans, then we would leave. And if Boris Johnson were to become prime minister, then we would leave. So on Friday, the 13th of December, 2019, then, you know, we woke up. I mean, I didn't actually go to bed because, of course, I stayed up to watch the election and witness this really grave moment in British history where Boris Johnson becomes prime minister. And so we knew that we were going to have to leave. I think it was going to be really complicated in hindsight with my job. I think it could have happened, but I think I would have always been the person that was away had it not been for the pandemic. And so the pandemic kind of gave me a bigger license to do what everyone is doing, which is work from home. And it's actually been entirely seamless. And I also am not sort of isolated in the fact that it's not everyone in the office and I'm the one that works away from home. And knowing that we're not going to go back to that full office arrangement again makes it a lot easier to manage. And I feel better. You know, I'd never picked up my son from school since I became a publisher 3 years ago. And now I pick him up every day because I start work much earlier when he goes to school, which is sort of 6 a.m. your time, 7 a.m. our time. And then I finish at sort of 2:30 UK time and go and pick him up. I spend some hours with him and then I kind of get back in and do whatever needs to be done in the evening, and I can get those final emails done. And importantly, reading, which is a huge part of my job, is sort of done. Lockdown's perfect for reading in some ways because there's no distractions of wanting to go out because you're not allowed to.
In terms of Berlin as a city, how does it feel to be like returning to this place that has held so much significance and marked this kind of start to a new chapter of your life all those years ago when you first moved there?
I mean, it's so interesting to really realise how much Berlin is home. So when we moved back to the UK after a year, it was very clear that my family weren't suited to London. It was just kind of not enough space, too big, too busy, and really sort of informal, and no one had time, you know. And so we moved to Bristol, and Bristol was really great, but we didn't really know that many people there. It wasn't really our home. And then coming back, I wasn't sure. It had been sort of 4.5, 5 years since we'd been away, and everyone in my family has changed, including our dog Ochi. It's like a different dog, but everyone has changed for the positive and has sort of reverted back into the family that we created here, you know, and that came together. And our son is so happy. You know, he identifies very much as being a Berliner and to being German. You know, he doesn't feel British. It doesn't. He feels, you know, this is his home. This is where he's born. We live in West Berlin. He was born in around the corner from where we live. And, you know, for him, it's home. My husband, he's a fluent German speaker. He's been able to slot into his job here and just have the life that he always thought he'd have when he moved here when he was 23. So we basically, like, it's a real glow up for us coming back, you know, like,
love that.
But we went from living in like a 50 square meter apartment to an 87 square meter apartment, and now we live in a 160 square meter apartment. So it's bigger than our four-story townhouse in Bristol. So we have lots of space, lots of light, and so space for you guys to come and stay, of course.
I was about to say, I'm inviting myself.
Candice has already been, so, you know,
really?
The spare room is Candice-ified, so, you know, but we love having people over. And I think as a Black British woman, you know, what's really interesting is that there's so many more Black people here than there were before. Every day I see Black people and I'm communicating with lots of Black British people that have moved over in the transition year. Kachenga's here, Simon Osunsade, who used to work for me here. Ghost Poet is here, Musa is here, you know, and so there's just like a real rich intellectual culture that's here. And I feel like I can say what I want to say, be who I am, and no holds barred, and that I'm not sort of not worried because I live in a truly liberal, sort of socialist, cultured city, as opposed to a deeply fractured capitalist city, which is how I see my home city of London now.
It would be lovely, sort of on that note, for you to read your extract for us.
It feels quite pertinent because the whole article is really touching on these moments where you physically move, but also you've kind of evolved as a person. So it feels like we're reading the right thing today. So yeah, if you could read that out, that would be amazing.
So one Wednesday afternoon in 1997, I packed up my belongings and left the home I'd grown up in. I thought we'd all have some cooling off time and I'd be back in a few months. In fact, I never went back and was never able to reconcile with my parents. The best way I can describe the relationship between me and my family is akin to Roald Dahl's Matilda. I wasn't an only child, but I was a lonely child, and I had an extraordinarily different perspective on the world compared to my parents. Our values were different. Although they were educated and had good jobs, I felt they were much more aspirational and consumerist, whilst I craved culture, books, and ideas. Over the time, these differences were exacerbated and expressed in our diverging attitudes and my inability to conform to their wishes. By the age of 16, it became clear that I was no longer able to live in my family home in a way that I would feel would be positive for my future. First stop was home of one of my best friends, Jessie. She, her family, and their dog, Sandy, welcomed me into their home for a period that I don't think that any of us realised would be as long and as exhausting as it was. Jessie's parents were kind, thoughtful, and gave us a lot of freedom. Freedom wasn't something I knew how to deal with, so I pushed boundaries, and I ran up huge phone bills, ate all the food, and generally ran amok. Not because I was meaning to be disrespectful, but because I wanted to do everything that I hadn't been allowed to do, and I had little understanding of how my behaviour affected others. Jessie's parents came to me one day with a triple-digit landline bill and explained that I would need to pay them back. I did, and it was clear that I also needed to move on. After some sofa surfing with various friends and family across London, I ended up staying in hostels in Soho. They were for young adults between 15 and 19, an age when the state is still responsible for you. After that, you were all on your own.
Thank you for sharing that, Charmaine. I was aware of pieces of your story from sort of interviewing you in the past, but I hadn't actually read this article before. So, yeah, it's a really powerful read. How does it feel to sort of look back on that moment now? And what sort of headspace were you in when you were writing that and sort of recounting that?
I think I wrote this during lockdown and I wrote it quite quickly. I think this time is it's at the forefront of my mind now more than ever, especially as I'm a mother and, you know, my son is 9 and I'm making these decisions. And I'm also kind of, I think I'm around the age that my mum probably was when I left home. So I'm trying to imagine what would it be like having a 16-year-old now, like what would have been the challenges and the hurdles and all of those things, whilst also not also giving too much space to someone, you know, my mother or my parents, you know, who I don't really know anymore because I haven't been in contact with them since that time. So, yeah, it's really reflective. And I just kind of can't quite believe that I got here. But I also, I'm not really sure what the alternative was because I could only do what I was going to do, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you spend a lot of time sort of with your son sort of preempting what his future will be like or what his behavior will be like and how you can sort of help shape and mold him?
Yeah, it's really interesting because recently we've been discussing what he wants to do in his future, and he'd always wanted to be a herpetologist. Always, he's nine. You know, he wanted to be a herpetologist, and so he wanted to study reptiles and amphibians in Eastern Europe. That was like his big thing. And then everything kind of hit with Black Lives Matter. And during lockdown, I've been teaching him from the beginning of lockdown. I couldn't really get on with what the schoolwork was and the process. So I'd been teaching him myself in the afternoons, and I set up a curriculum where I was teaching him the culture and histories of African and Caribbean nations. And I had bought loads of books and been sent loads of books and did a big call out on Twitter. So this is in March, you know, this is before the murder of George Floyd, because as Black people, we know that our history is relevant before moments that white people come into it. And it was really important to me that I took this time to kind of teach my son as we were homeschooling. And what was really interesting is that actually George Floyd's murder sort of intercepted in my teaching. So I decided to teach him about civil rights and activism and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Rosa Parks. And he had to write an essay every day about it. And
very classic, Shami.
Yeah, like, I love that that is Jackson's curriculum has been that. That's amazing.
Well, you know, it starts and it continues, you know, and it will continue throughout his whole life. Like, I'm still learning about all of this stuff. There's so many details that I'm still learning about, and kernel, the nugget, you know, has to start from somewhere. So recently we've been talking about how people are useful within society and what kind of jobs are useful. And so I've been saying to him, you know, if you're really interested in the environment, if you're really interested in human rights, which he is, then I think you should be looking towards becoming a lawyer rather than a scientist, because like your maths isn't that hot, you know, like actually your language skills, your story skills, etc., are like really, really great. And your sort of understanding of justice. And I'm like, let's look at some really amazing Black lawyers. Let's look at people like Amal Clooney, and I'll tell you what they do. And now he's very much like, he can see that as a path. I'm like, in the future, as the environment, climate change changes, as politics and the far right come more into the fore, we're going to need people who have skills and jobs where they can actually help people. So, for example, Colston, the statue, you know, my son went to Colston School in Bristol. We were there. We watched the statue come down.
Of course you were there.
And, you know, and then I explained to him that, like, you know, these people might go to prison, and that now I've got to try and find some lawyers to help them. And it'd be really great if we found some Black lawyers specifically and barristers to help them. And in explaining all of those things, you're kind of making those connections of like, that can also be you. And so anyway, now he told my grandma last night that he wants to be a lawyer, his great grandma. So you imagine how proud she was.
You're like, it's working, it's worked, the seeds have been planted. Yeah, and what a time and a moment for him to have been present for. I'm really interested in this idea of, like, you sharing your story, right? Because writing about these things in a magazine is a very, like, public and exposing thing to do, and you're a publisher and someone whose job is very much about facilitating other people's stories in many ways. Did it come natural to you to share your story in this way? Have you always been like super open?
That's such an interesting question, because it's kind of an accident of things, you know. So let's say when I had my bookshop in Berlin when I was 27, I wasn't a confident writer, you know. So everything that I wrote, my husband and my assistant would always check over, and they would highlight all the mistakes that I'd make, and then they would sort of, through looking at the mistakes, and I just kind of learned how to write. And now it's really interesting that I still get my husband to look over everything, but he doesn't have as many corrections, you know. Before it was like all red. So I had to go through my own process of sort of learning how to be a better writer. And also because I've always read so broadly, then I've understood how a narrative structure should work. And so I sort of had all these tools at my disposal. So now I just kind of use those with the experience I have, and writing something like that just flows. I looked at old school publishers from many years ago and really felt like, you know, to be a publisher, I'm doing what I'm doing, where I publish underrepresented voices and marginalized voices. or people from marginalized backgrounds. So it was really, really, really important to be a strong voice as part of that and kind of lead the way. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that I need to write a book, but it does mean that I should be able to tell my story and inspire other people, because there's lots of different aspects to it and there aren't any kind of rules. Like, I haven't followed these rules, and if that can be inspiring to other people, especially, like, you know, your audience, for example, then I'm okay with putting myself out there, because I realized there weren't so many people that I could look up to when I was younger. I was just following my own path stubbornly and blindly, and I want to inspire other people to do that. So if that means I have to be open about my story, even if it doesn't make me always that comfortable, then so be it.
Thank you, Charmaine. In the latter half of the article, which we didn't quite get to in your extract, you speak about not being able to prove you were homeless and therefore not being eligible for social housing, and you also speak a bit about the disbelief of others when they hear your story and they hear your voice. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and what it was like to go through that?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have a really complicated relationship with class in the UK and the expectations of what people from different races or class should be. And being my intersectional experience is that I am a Black woman from a middle class environment who had working class experiences, and that experience of sort of leaving home and, you know, being on the street and being homeless is more of a working class experience, but that wasn't the environment that I came from. So I had to learn how to navigate that, and it was really difficult because I also never wanted to change who I was. And one thing that's very hard to change is your accent. And when I was younger, in Clapham Junction, I would always be taunted. I suppose bullying is sort of too strong, but sort of taunted by people saying, like, you know, you think you're white or you're too posh to be Black and all of that stuff. And it, you know, I used to have a cello and I went to a convent school and I'd have my cello on my back and I'd be like, I had this haircut, like I had a bob that was relaxed. And so
classic haircut.
And they used to call me olive oil because I was really tall and skinny with really long feet. I'm like size 8. And it was just, you know, I was just very cute and just wanting to play the cello and, you know, just get on with my life. And a lot of people were just like, who are you? And then, you know, then I would start quoting like Dr. Maya Angelou or Malcolm X, and I would talk and I'd be talking about like the freedom of the people, and I'd literally be shouting at them and telling them that they have enslaved minds. And they were just like, what are you talking about? And I was just like, listen, you know, I'm the granddaughter of the Harlem Renaissance. And they're just like, what? This is just how I was raised, you know, to know about literature, to know about our history in it. And the idea that I should have one particular accent when I actually spoke like everyone I grew up around was just really bizarre. But it meant that it was really hard to navigate a system where essentially I should have like a council flat in zone 1-2 somewhere that I've already sold multiple times. But I didn't get that because the state were also just like, who are you? And so I was used to that from a really, really young age. You know, I didn't have anywhere to live. I didn't have parents. I never went home, and I should have been given a home. But I wasn't, because they were like, you can do this by yourself. And they were like, there's a privilege. So I already understood that I had this privilege. And so then my thing was to work out how to use it for my own good, and then in turn use it for greater good. And basically that's kind of been my story.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say I can very much empathize with being the cello girl at school. My friends used to call me Turtle when I'd like rock up.
I'd
rock up to school with my cello on my back. But I didn't realise that you used to play when you were little as well. But anyway, that's the least important part of the story you just told.
Well, no, I think that is really important, because this is the thing, is about understanding where we all connect and the experiences that we have. And these really small things, if you don't ask the question, if you don't delve into what people are doing, then you're not gonna find this out, and then you don't connect. And I think, you know, lots of people have these kinds of experiences but haven't necessarily had the ability or the platform or whatever to express themselves. And there's a lot of people who probably had experiences like mine or yours who never, to use the turtle analogy, like never came out of their shell and never got to realize who they could be. And so in some ways I'm happy to write my story in order to pay homage to those people as well who didn't get to have that sort of freedom, I suppose.
I love to have this picture of this like young Charmaine with the bob and the size 8 feet and the cello and the books and the quotes, like, and I love it. And I think you mentioned, you know, some of the authors that have shaped your understanding of the world that we live in. And we've spoken a lot about the importance of understanding legacy, and it's why I've also like decided to go back into education. And yeah, I've not finished my reading for this week, so let's not talk about it. And you mentioned there was this line, you mentioned that reading Baldwin and Morrison and Angelo have kind of given you this foundation for empathy, and it would be great if you could explain a little bit more about what you meant when you said that in the article.
Yeah, it's so interesting, because a really good friend of mine, her daughter just read The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, but she'd actually read The Vanishing Half first. And so her and I had a call the other day that was like an hour and a half where we just sort of talked about it. And, you know, she's a white, middle-class, privileged girl who has a zest for life and is 16 years old and is really kind of on point on so many things. I have so much respect for this young woman. And it was just so interesting, because I was like, what was that like reading The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett, and then, you know, which is about passing, and then reading The Bluest Eye? Because I read The Bluest Eye when I was sort of 14 years old. And when I was 14, you know, this idea of sort of beauty and blackness was just, it was given to me in a really different way. It was always sort of through sexuality, and it was through sort of salt and pepper, or it was through kind of black women soul groups and R&B groups, and a sort of an objectification. It was always about love and like wanting a man to love you, and that lust that's felt, and how do you feel when a man feels about you. And so having this literature kind of gave me a completely different understanding that, one, people don't have to have a man love them, and men can love men through Baldwin, and two, that, you know, to not be white and blonde and blue eyes was actually an incredible thing, because you had more stories to tell and that your life was richer. And also through sort of people like Terry McMillan, like how Stella got her groove back, etc. You know, that thing of like sisterhood and friendship, these were like the foundations of my life. And I was reading these outside of school and going to the libraries and speaking to my uncles and, you know, my cousins about it. And it was just really interesting. And it didn't occur to me that it was so different, or that we would be in the situation that we are today. Because to me, it's like I grew up with a rich cacophony of voices encouraging me to be who I am. And obviously, you know, every parent wants their child to read, but I don't think that my parents had really thought about like the impact that it would have on me, that I would become this like very strong, opinionated young woman from such an early age. Like, it just actually meant that our relationship didn't work. And so that was the sort of the tough side of it. But I felt incredibly empowered by these voices. You know, Dr. Maya Angelou, How the Caged Bird Sings, you know, I mean, I've never been through anything that she went through. And so I always knew that people had it worse than me. And so therefore, I've always been grateful, even if it's been tough. And that's what literature has really given me. And I think that's why, although at the top you said that I've had lots and lots of different jobs, I feel like I've only ever had one job, which is to match readers with great storytelling. And that I've done that in lots of different ways.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think it's an interesting kind of distinction, and an important distinction, that I haven't kind of done loads and loads of different things. I've just kind of been experimental with how do we capture readers, and how do we have these illuminating moments that literature brings.
Yeah. And I'll never forget the time where you took me and Georgina Lawton, who's just got her book coming out now actually, to Foyles in central London, and sort of picked out some books for us, one of which is like my favorite book like ever, and it was Here Comes the Sun by Nicole Dennis Bett.
I love that book. Yeah, I feel like it's really important. And I think that we were having drinks after we'd just been to the theater, and we were having drinks and we were going to go for dinner, and I was like, have you read this or have you read that? And you guys were talking about writing, and I was like, No, like read, and then your writing will really come. And I've said that to both of you in the past, and I can also see that it's true. Like, I can also see through your writing, both of you, over the like 5-6 years that I've known you, I can really see that, like, you know, your writing is changing, because you're just like the influence. It's not just sort of your opinion, you're drawing all these different references, and it's built this foundation. And that's all I want, really, you know, is that where people have questions about us, especially as Black women and queer Black women, about like our rights, then the thing that we can do in this world is show people, like, we have history, we have form, we know what to do with it, we are confident, and you can't tell us no, because the reality is that, you know, we are standing on the shoulders of greatness, and we know what that greatness is. And when you don't know, then you can be, it's like a pyramid, you know, if you build a pyramid properly, then it's like, you can't, the foundations can't shake, but you can be really shaken if you don't have those foundations, if you don't know what came before. And I feel like, you know, that's just the auntie in me now.
But I feel like it's important to note that I feel like the first time you meet you, Charmaine, is like a very special moment. And I feel like we both had lots of thoughts and feelings and emotions and, you know, all sorts, and comparing notes of what was it like when you first met Charmaine, when we didn't really know you that well. Yeah, I feel like with our first meeting, there was a lot of conversation and a lot of wine.
A lot of wine. There's always a lot of wine.
And we met under quite unusual circumstances as well, because I was eavesdropping. I didn't know you. I didn't know who you were at the time, but I remember eavesdropping. You were having a conversation on a train in Loughborough Junction about like the publishing industry and how, why it, I can't remember what the conversation was. And I just, and I don't ever do this.
I probably was talking about how white it was and how awful it was. And I was on a Southeastern train.
Yeah, yeah. Some standard stuff. And I don't really do this, but I remember inserting myself and being like, oh, that's, I don't know if I said hi or whatever, but that kind of marked the start of this. Of this like friendship relationship, which is funny to think back to now.
I know, and I think that that's the thing, is that there's sort of serendipity and sort of understanding that sometimes you need to be connected to something or someone who is in a space where you want to engage in, you know. And I'm 39 now, so I'm really taking on my auntie stance like quite seriously. And I'm just really, I'm so proud of seeing you guys specifically, but like a range of the next generation, like really come through and really mean it, and to have that sort of politicized and activist heart in everything that you're doing, and understanding how difficult it is. I think that for my generation, I think because we come from the boomers generation, so I think people just thought it would be how it was before. And I think it's harder for my generation to really see like the challenges that are ahead, because everything's been quite comfortable. You know, it's been quite comfortable since the 80s and 90s and with a blip of 2008. But for you guys, it's just different. And I think it's much more raw. It's much more what it was like for people in the 20s, in their 20s in the 1980s, you know. And I think that was sort of my parents' generation, and who are now in their 60s. And so I think, you know, you have it all there, and you have this history, you have this foundation, and I'm just really happy to be part of helping to kind of navigate it and also learn from you guys as well. I'm constantly inspired by what you're doing. I feel like it's a really positive exchange, and that we're all equal. So thank you for everything.
Yeah, that's lovely to hear. And I'm sure you already know this, but you are like literally like our hero and someone we can always depend on for like solid advice and
honestly through the tears, through the trauma, through the good days, through all of it. Mm-hmm. So we really do appreciate you. Mm-hmm. And this could easily just turn into a love fest.
Yeah. I love you guys.
So just one final question on the extract. You speak in the piece about how you would have never dared to dream about the job you now have, which is really interesting, because you outwardly are someone who exudes like so much confidence. And even just hearing you say about your husband checking your writing, that surprised me. I was like, what, Charmaine wasn't confident about her writing? So when do you think that you first sort of dared to dream big and sort of grasp that for the first time?
I think it's again about knowing that foundation, like I said, and feeling like you've had that education or you've known what to do. And I didn't study English literature, so I think, you know, it was just really important. Also, when I was younger, when I was 14, 15, and I had to read out in class, I used to really stutter. You know, I couldn't read in class. I'd feel so nervous. And so, for example, you only asked me to read the extract like 2 minutes before I did it. And I can't believe that I didn't stumble over a word, you know, like, again, I as I was reading it, I was thinking, oh my God, you've come so far, like you can literally just read something now. And so it's just practice, I suppose, and being put in situations. With my job, what happened was that I'd been to a dinner. It was a really posh publishing dinner in Mayfair, which was it was called the Society of Bookmen, but they decided to call it the Society after a vote. They decided to call it the Society of Book People. It was one of those dinners that feels like formal hall in Cambridge. So when they call your name, they would say, Charmaine Lovegrove, publisher of Dialogue Books, has been invited by Julia Kingsford of Kingsford Campbell. And then everyone would clap and you're just like, what is this? And I noticed that the issue in publishing is very much about women and women being at the top and the gender balance. But I also noticed that I was the only Black person in this room of about 150 people. So after the dinner, I had a private members club, Soho House, and I invited three people to come with me. One of those people was Charlie King, who is the MD of Little Brown. The other is Philip Jones, who is the editor of The Bookseller, which is a trade magazine for publishing, and also Julia Kingsford, who invited me. The long story short, we ended up having a conversation about the diversity issue of The Bookseller that was coming out the next day. There was a fact that is out of 165,000 books that were published in the UK in 2016, less than 100 were published by people of colour and only one black male debut was published. We just got into a really big conversation about it. It was really interesting. And I suggested that they start an imprint. Now, I'd at Little Brown, because I just watched the Virago documentary and saw how Little Brown had Virago, which is a feminist imprint that was started like 45 years ago. I didn't believe that I would become a publisher. Like, that wasn't really what I was thinking I'd be doing, especially because I hadn't come through that editorial route. But then I had lunch with Charlie King a few months later, and I realized that it was actually an interview and that he was interviewing me to run this imprint that I'd devised. And I came out of that lunch and I called Toby Coventry, who was my business partner for Dialogue Scouting, which is our book to film consultancy. I called him and said, if I don't do this job, I think I'm gonna have to leave the publishing industry because I think I've just talked myself into becoming a publisher. And so that's really how it happened. And then I did some work on a business plan and I went to Jamaica and I spent time and, you know, and I had people like Candice help me and Ella Wakatami, who looked through my plans. I spoke to other publishers, etc. And I gained confidence that actually I could be a publisher. You know, I didn't have to know, my grammar doesn't have to be perfect because there's people that do that. I had to understand how the job worked. But I did have a vision, and I did have a vision of what kinds of books could be published. And the books that I felt could be published are the books that I'm publishing. So that's kind of how it worked. And I don't think you can really dream of these things, you know, because these roles don't open up without you pushing down the door, basically. What happened was that I was confident enough to say, this should happen. And then at some point I was like, oh, I'm the person that should do it, rather than trying to think who else could do it. I was like, oh, I could do this. And actually I'd really love it. And it turns out that I love it more than I could ever have dreamed of. And that's the beauty of it.
Amazing. Incredible. I think the final thing that we want to ask you really is, considering this like massive growth journey and, you know, where you started, where you are now, the different experiences that you've had, what do you think that younger Charmaine, who perhaps didn't have the confidence to read out loud, would think about where you are now?
Oh my God, I'm going to cry. I'm going to cry. I just think she'd be so proud. I think she'd be so amazed. And I think she would say, this is, you were right to keep working hard and you were right to stick to what you believed in. You know, you have to remember that, as I said, coming from the sort of middle class part of Battersea, a lot of my friends went on to be sort of lawyers and doctors and do things that are really useful to society. And I just was the one that worked in the bookshop, and I'd meet them for dinner and they'd always, you know, near their work and their chambers or whatever. And it was always really nice. And they would always, you know, and all the parents would be like, oh, it's so sweet that you work in a bookshop. Just so lovely, Charmaine. But I just where I felt safe and how I felt comfortable. And so it was really difficult to sort of, it wasn't even that difficult to not be seen as sort of successful, because that wasn't what I was chasing. So to have made a success, to be financially, have more financial security, to have an amazing partner and a wonderful child and great friends and, you know, and to create my own family is just something that I could have only have dreamed of. And to also be doing that in a different country, in a different language as well, is beyond anything that I would have thought as sort of 11, 12, 13-year-old Charmaine, where I was probably at my most happiest. I was at my most I was at my saddest when I was 11, 12, 13. So I can't imagine that this is the reality. So, yeah, I think you have to stick to the things that you believe in if you're doing it for the right reasons. And, yeah, I can't believe I'm crying as I say this. But
no, it's beautiful, honestly. Mm.
You know, it's really hard. Like, sleeping on the streets is really, really, really difficult. And I wouldn't wish it on anyone. And people telling you no because of how you look or how you sound is really a tragedy in our society when people don't get what they need because of assumptions of who they are. And now I'm in a position to fight that. And so that's the core of everything that I do and why I do it, because I don't want other people to be in this state.
I mean, we just can't wait to see what you do next. And I'm actually reading The Vanishing Half at the moment. And like, yeah, it's, you know, you've published so many beautiful, brilliant books. It's in the, how many years has it been? Two years?
Three years. Yeah.
I will be in Berlin soon. And and thank you so much for joining us. Honestly, it was beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's Growing Up with Galdem. We really appreciate you for listening and supporting. It was really beautiful to be joined by Charmaine Lovegrove, who we've known for some time and has been there for so many kind of significant moments, I think, in both our lives. Sorry if the sound quality wasn't incredible. Charlie managed to lock herself out of her house and so Ubered it over to me. So we were doing it in a slightly makeshift setting. But if you've enjoyed the podcast and the rest of the series, then please, please, please do subscribe, like, share, tell your mates about it, share it, and also sign up to become a Galdem member at our website, where you will find lots of incredible, groundbreaking content. So thank you for joining us today. This has been an II Studios production.
Thank you so much for listening. We really hope you enjoyed this episode and that you'll tune into the next one.
You can find Growing Up with Galdem on Apple Podcasts, the Acast app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave us a review, rate us, and subscribe. It really helps the show. And if you'd like to find out more about Galdem, you can head over to our Instagram page at Galdemzine. That's GALDEMZINE. Or you can visit our website, which is GAL hyphen, which is important, DEM.com.
Galdem has a book which is out now. It's called I Will Not Be Erased, Our Stories About Growing Up as People of Colour. You can find it in all good bookstores or online.
Thank you so much for listening.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.